I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. By the end of April, there were more than 700 confirmed cases of measles across the United States. Six states were experiencing outbreaks of more than three cases, although single cases were much more widespread. This is the biggest outbreak of measles since 1994, and it threatens the status of the very contagious illness as officially eliminated from the United States. Vermont officials are monitoring the situation and preparing for the potential of cases here. So today we're going to learn about those preparations underway for measles in Vermont, as well as the broader picture of vaccines and immunizations around the state. We're joined now by Christine Finley, the Immunization Program Manager with Vermont Department of Health. Chris Finley, nice to have you with us again.
Thank you.
And Dr. Rebecca Bell, a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Bell, nice to have you back with us as well.
Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit about the measles and what we know about this outbreak and the potential for it to come here, because 22 states have at least one case of measles, but one case of measles isn't considered a localized outbreak. More than three cases, I guess, are considered a localized outbreak. It's a little bit confusing, especially once we bring in the idea that measles has been officially eliminated when clearly it hasn't been eliminated. So let's talk a little bit about all of that. Chris Finley, do you expect to see a case of measles here in Vermont related to this outbreak this year?
It wouldn't surprise us. When we look at measles, it's highly contagious. We know that there's been cases in three of the New England states.
And a big outbreak in New York.
Big outbreak in New York. We know that people are traveling. And we have areas where kids and people may not be fully vaccinated, and so they'll be susceptible to acquiring measles.
How often do we actually have a case of measles in Vermont?
Well, we haven't had a lot in the last 10 years. We had a case in 2011, and then we had a case in 2018. And the case in 2018 you may not have heard about because they developed measles while abroad, and it was diagnosed. I mean, they weren't infectious when they got back here, and so you wouldn't have heard a thing about that one.
So it was a Vermonter who had a case of measles, but not a case in Vermont?
Correct.
Okay, so really 2011, did you say? 2012
yes, was 2011.
The last case? Okay. And is there anything that you can do? I mean, you can't set up barriers around the state of Vermont, and as you said, people travel all the time. So is there any way, short of the longer-term stuff that we're going to talk about with immunization rates, to prevent measles from coming here?
Not that I know of. Immunization is the key to prevention.
Now, Dr. Bell, a lot of families with either immune-compromised children or babies who are not yet able to get the MMR vaccination are really worried about this and wonder, well, okay, so what do I do as a parent or as somebody responsible for children to try to make sure that the children in my care don't get measles?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I encourage everyone to talk to their pediatrician about this. There are exceptions that we can make if someone's traveling to an area where there are known measles cases or they've been known to be exposed. And so typically we give the first dose of MMR around 12 months of age, but it's perfectly safe and fine to give it as early as 6 months. So if an infant has been exposed or they might be through travel, we recommend the vaccine early, around 6 months, and we recommend the second dose, which usually isn't given until the child's around 4 to 5 years old. We can give that one earlier as well. And so talking to your pediatrician about that is really important. If you have a child that cannot get the MMR because they're immunocompromised or for some other reason, if there is any question of exposure, they really need to talk to their pediatrician right away because they need to sort of get in. And there are some things, special treatments that we can try to give them to help prevent them from getting sick.
Like what?
So if it's a patient that can get the vaccine, even if they haven't gotten it but they've been exposed, we give the vaccine right away because it does give the child a chance to make their own antibodies and to fight off this infection. So it can lessen the infection. The other thing we can do is to give passive antibodies. And so those are antibodies from other people that we can give to someone who, say, can't get the vaccine themselves. And that doesn't work as well.
But do you do that through a blood transfusion?
Yeah, it's an injection or an infusion. That's right. Yep.
Okay, so you could do that for a child who was perhaps immunocompromised who couldn't get the vaccine. That's an acceptable treatment for some children?
Yes, that's right. And I wouldn't really call it a treatment. It's another way to help prevent the patient from getting sick. It's not a, we don't have any direct treatments that can act against the virus, but it's a way to take other people's antibodies from donor plasma who are immune to measles and to give them those antibodies to help protect them.
One of the things that we often talk about with measles and other communicable diseases for which there are vaccines is that we try to get to a place of herd immunity. And can you, Chris Finley, describe what herd immunity is and how much of the population needs to be vaccinated for us to officially consider ourselves there?
Sure. Herd or community immunity is when you have a high enough vaccination rate that the disease cannot take hold and be transferred within a population. The rate that you need in order to prevent that depends on how contagious the disease is. And so the typical one we always say with measles, which there's much research on, is about 93 to 95% of the population needs to be vaccinated to prevent that from spreading. And that's because it's contagious not only when you cough, but it remains in the air and it can stay in a place for up to 2 hours afterwards, which contributes to it.
And we're right at about 93% overall for kindergartners in Vermont for the MMR vaccine?
We are. And we're even higher for when we look at the whole population of grades K through 12. But what we do see is that when we look at individual schools and school data for the MMR vaccine and all the required vaccines is on the website, we'll see wide variability with some schools that may have MMR vaccination rates as low as 48%, 40%, and then many that are in 99 to 100%.
And just remind us, when we're talking about the requirement for vaccinations in Vermont, that requirement is related to public school attendance. So
no, that requirement is related to all schools, so public and independent schools.
So independent schools that have a 40% immunization rate, they are families that have taken either the religious exemption or the medical exemption?
They have either done the religious or the medical exemption, or they're provisionally admitted. But the law only allows the school to provisionally admit someone without basically their record or an exemption for up to 6 months.
If you homeschool your child, do you have to follow the vaccination standard in Vermont?
You do not. The whole idea is that you've got this congregate area where students are all coming together. Some states may require it, but we do not.
We've seen in New York and some other places that are seeing these very large measles outbreaks that they are making some changes. New York State initiating fines for people who are unvaccinated, not letting people into public spaces if they're unvaccinated. Do you think that's something Vermont should do?
Not at this point at all. I think we followed the New York very carefully, and what's happened is they're having such difficulty getting control of the spread of it, and that's why you've seen the cases go up. I think we're now at 764 in the country. And so this I was just reading about that. It feels like it's a last-ditch effort that they're trying to do, because realize there's also children in school that can't be immunized, and then there's, you know, there's with every vaccine, it's not 100% effective. Even though two doses are 97% effective, there's those kids that are at risk.
Heather is calling in from East Randolph. Hi, Heather. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, with a resurgence of measles across the country, what are your thoughts about revaccinating people who already received the vaccine as children or young adults about 20 to 40 years ago?
Heather, thanks for your question, and I'll add on Shannon's, who wrote in with a similar one to say, should adults and healthcare workers be checked to see if they have immunity? I have three kids, and for the third, some routine blood work at 8 weeks showed I was no longer immune. I was given the MMR vaccine, or maybe a booster, before I left the hospital with my third baby. I'm relieved I wasn't exposed to rubella during that pregnancy. So for Shannon and Heather, Chris Finley, what about adults who may have been immunized a long time ago?
Oh, this is the most common question that we're getting. Thank you both very much for asking. The first thing is, if you were born before 1957, you're immune. So there was so much measles circulating there. You likely had it and you're immune. The other thing is, if you have laboratory evidence, in other words, if blood work was done, we call it a titer, to show that you're protected, or if you have confirmation that you had measles, you're also protected. And then we look at pretty much most adults are protected. If you're doing international travel, if you're going somewhere and you were born after 1957, that is when you need to have two doses. That is when we're careful on that. Also, if you're a healthcare provider, that's also another time.
What about childcare workers?
There's nothing specific. That's a very good question. There's no specific rules that we have for childcare workers, but making sure you're protected not only would be probably important for them. Many of the childcare workers tend to be younger, but not all, but it's worth looking at. And when they looked at the cases that had occurred recently, the median age was 5 years of age. And almost 50% of those cases had occurred in children less than 5 years of age. And so we're really seeing this in the younger children that don't have protection. But for those adults that aren't sure, they can check with their doctor, and there may be a time where one dose is indicated. If you're going on international travel or you're a healthcare provider, two doses are indicated. But the bottom line is most adults are usually at very low risk for measles.
So Anderson and Adam both are worried about the response to this measles outbreak. Anderson says there have been measles outbreaks every year since the government declared it eliminated. Just because the government says it so doesn't make it so. Quit creating unnecessary fear and panic. The disease was already on the decline before the vaccine was even started. And Adam says all this uproar over 700 cases in a population of over 325 million people, this, quote, problem is sensationalist fear-mongering. My generation, we almost all had measles as kids, and we all ended up fine. Dr. Bell, how do you respond?
Well, I can give a little bit of background on that because I think that's helpful. So prior to the vaccine being introduced in 1963, most people did get measles. Most people did well, meaning that they recovered from it. They were miserable for a period of time but fully recovered. However, during that time period, every year, we had about 48,000 hospitalizations, 1,000 cases of encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain that can lead to permanent brain damage, and about 400 to 500 deaths every year from measles. So when you have a large population getting sick from measles, we are going to see serious side effects and complications and deaths, unfortunately. Looking at recent outbreaks, and estimating, again, what that would look like for us if we started seeing more measles cases. About 1 in 20 people who get measles will have pneumonia, and this is the most common cause of death in children. About 1 in 1,000 who get measles will have that brain swelling that I mentioned, and about 1 to 2 out of 1,000 will die. And again, we're talking about children here mostly. And this is all preventable. So it is really important that we keep an eye on what's going on. To address the elimination piece, in 2000, the U.S. declared measles eliminated. And what that means is that we don't have constant transmission of measles. We don't have a constant presence of the disease in this country. However, we always still have cases, but it can vary widely. So in 2004, for instance, we only had like 34 cases. In 2014 was our big year. We had about 600. And as we know, this year we already have more than 700. So what that looks like is we have people who live in the U.S. who are unvaccinated that go and travel, or foreign travelers to the U.S. who come to the U.S. and they're infected with measles. They probably don't know it. And if they show up and they're exposing a community that's really immune, you might see a couple of cases, one or two or just a couple of cases. However, if they're going to an under-vaccinated community like we're seeing in New York, so those are travelers to Israel going back to New York, then you start to see an outbreak. So yes, we always do have cases here and there, but the reason why we're so concerned is because this is the largest number we've seen. And because measles is so highly contagious, it's easily spread, it can really be a canary in the coal mine, if you will, among infectious disease resurgence. So the first thing we'll see when communities are under-vaccinated is measles. But that also means that if people are under-vaccinated with against other diseases, we're going to start seeing resurgence of some of the other serious diseases that we prevent with vaccines.
Can you name a few of them that you're concerned about?
Yeah, so some of the other diseases that are a little less contagious, but I really worry about in babies are like Haemophilus influenza type B, which causes really serious meningitis. We used to have about 25,000 cases a year of Hib-related meningitis and pneumonia. Now we see about 10 a year, and pediatricians are really worried about something like that coming back. Pneumococcus is another example. So because measles is so easily spread, it just shows us, it shows public health officials, wow, we really need to get a hold of this and really work on this.
Can I come back to what you were talking about just a moment ago, Dr. Bell, with the rates of serious complications for people who have measles? Because as we've seen, most people who have had measles in the past and who have it now are okay. It's not a pleasant experience, but there's not a serious complication. And you mentioned that about 1 in 20 of the young children who get it might get pneumonia. 1 in 1,000, I think you said, could get encephalitis. How does that compare with the rates of adverse reactions to the vaccine? Because obviously you have to weigh the potential complications of getting the illness versus the potential complications of getting the vaccine.
Yes, good question. So the adverse reactions for the vaccine, the most common one are fevers, soreness at the injection site. There is a rare side effect where platelets, which is a blood clotting factor, can be lowered temporarily with this. Fevers are pretty common afterwards, but we don't see things like, you know, pneumonia, for instance, and we don't see things like deaths like we would in the actual infection.
So we got a question from Rocky who says, seriously, well, not really a question from Rocky, but a comment from Rocky. Seriously, measles is a rash and a fever. It was a rite of passage for decades and had a very, very low death rate before the vaccine was universally rolled out in 1968. The first vaccine was a failure. Now measles is being treated like it's Ebola. This is pure propaganda. Let's start working on the real threats to our population. So, Chris Finley, when we think about the measles and when we think about, first of all, what is it? But then also, yeah, why is there this focus on an illness that is not causing and would not cause as much death as other illnesses, as other threats to our populations? You know, why is this something that we still focus on?
Oh, we focus on it because it's a nasty disease. If you've talked with people that have had measles, some may say that it wasn't that bad. That's the rare response that you get. And it may have lifetime impact also. I mean, when you first have it, it's fever, it's cough, it's conjunctivitis, it's a runny nose, it's the rash. I mean, people are sick for a good 8 to 10 days sometimes. And so it's not actually so simple. And when we talk about the sequelae, encephalitis, where you can be left with altered functioning the rest of your life, that you can't pick who's going to get that. I think the other concern is I really had hoped that measles would go the way of smallpox and the way we're hoping to see polio, where not only do we eliminate the transmission, but we eradicate the disease. The only reservoir is humans. So it's humans that spread this. And as we eliminated it and then looked at further reductions, and there were big worldwide efforts to address measles, it's so frustrating to see that this is bouncing back so rapidly. I think over 87,000 cases in Europe last year. So that's also part of the concern in the U.S. is once it does start to take hold and spread, how will we stop it and slow it down? The other thing that I'll mention is the cost to public health and to society. I think there's estimates that each cost, it runs between each case, maybe $32,000, $35,000, $50,000, depending on what you read. So in terms of this is a disease that could be prevented and possibly could be eradicated, but yet we're putting all these people at risk and all these resources are being used.
Spencer is calling in from Colchester. Hi, Spencer. You have thoughts today?
Hello, am I on?
You are on.
Excellent. I will make this fast because I know time is short. 20 years ago, when I was studying research material every day, I ran across some information about vaccines that really startled me. The first was a paper by Dr. Koss to the Society for Infectious Diseases, which would have claimed it medical heresy to claim that medical intervention is what eradicated infectious diseases in America. That spawned a study by Dr. McKinley and McKinley, which came out in 77, studying mortality rates from 1900 to 1974. And what they showed was there was only a 1 to 3.5% effect that all of modern medicine had on the drop in death rates from infectious diseases.
So, Spencer, let me focus you here. Is the question or the thought that you want to have our guest discuss this question about whether or not the vaccine would be responsible for a drop in measles?
Well, what I'm concerned about is a false framing here, where it seems like issues of hygiene, not vaccine, did more to eradicate infectious diseases than the vaccines did.
All right. So, Spencer, let's put that first to Chris Finley with the Vermont Department of Health. This question of, you know, we say, look what the vaccine has done. How do we know that it's the vaccine that's doing that as opposed to better hygiene, better health, better nutrition, more wealth in a country like the United States that we know from other studies does lead to better health outcomes already?
Yes. And we do know that factors like sanitation have made a big difference. One of the things that is clearly studied is what is the morbidity? What is the illness related to this either virus or bacteria prior to introduction of a vaccine, and then it's monitored. There's surveillance that goes on each year following that and looking at that. The other thing is that studies are done of those that got the disease to identify who was vaccinated, who wasn't vaccinated. So all of the effectiveness data that we look at is based on that.
Anything to add, Dr. Bell?
Yeah, I would say that we started monitoring measles deaths in the U.S. in about 1912, and during that decade, what was reported was about 6,000 deaths every year. And then as the decades went on and we did improve our supportive care efforts, again, we don't have an antiviral medication, but our ability to put people on ventilators who have pneumonia, our ability to give intravenous fluids, all of those things improved. We did decrease the death rate from measles. However, still 400 people were dying every year in the U.S. from measles before the vaccine was introduced. And on an individual level, as a pediatric intensive care doctor, anytime a child is critically ill and that critical illness is preventable, that is something that we should work towards.
We got a note from Alex in Woodstock who says, I'm willing to trust all of the thousands of doctors, scientists, and epidemiologists who make it their life to study vaccines rather than people who do 10 minutes of research on fake news websites. And Lynn says, people that are unable to receive the measles vaccine, like people who are immunocompromised or children with leukemia, are at risk of dying because some people selfishly decide to not vaccinate. But Don says, there's a huge push for mandatory vaccination triggered by outbreaks of measles, but this is a mild disease in well-nourished populations. There are legitimate reasons for opposing mandatory vaccination. Foremost among those should be the ethics of forcing anyone to take medication against their will. Is the issue of measles so serious that we must force parents to vaccinate when they believe it's wrong and harmful? Chris Finley, philosophically, how do you think about that?
The word force is something that's a difficult one. I think when you look at the need for community, for immunity to protect the other children with something that you have, that is important. I think that some of the decisions that have been made in New York City and New York State were made after months and months of trying to work through this and to follow it. But I do think in places where you're trusting and putting your child in a school, that there's a certain responsibility that we have to ensure that children are vaccinated, and so that those that can't be vaccinated are also protected, and that we don't allow the spread of diseases unnecessarily that are going to harm them.
Olga's calling in from Morristown. Hi, Olga. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So my question is, as a parent, my number one concern is safety. So I was wondering if anyone there could review, like, the safety studies for the current CDC schedule and any new updates for the current measles outbreak. This is just a huge concern, especially when pharma companies can't be held liable for their products, and vaccine injury is something that is very real.
Olga, thanks for the call.
Safety, yeah, anytime you're requiring a vaccine for school or recommending a vaccine and you're putting something into a healthy child, safety is of paramount importance, and I completely agree with that. I actually attend the meetings at the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices where they make the recommendations, and I've been there the last 4 years. And what I will say is there's an enormous amount of data that goes on before any recommendation is made. They review, they look at it, and after a recommendation is made, they continue to come back with follow-up data to look at the impact of that recommendation once it's out in the population. And there are studies that are going on at universities. There are studies CDC is involved with. And, of course, drug manufacturers are also doing the studies. But it is not solely relied on drug manufacturer data.
You know, while we're talking about the risks, Tim says it's right on the insert that comes with each vaccine, may cause injury or death. Doctors don't know the contents of vaccines now. They're just parroting the pharma companies. Dr. Bell, what is actually in the MMR vaccine. And, you know, you do look at the potential adverse side effects. And as a parent, you know, many parents look at that and think, oh, my gosh, you know, this could really hurt my child.
Yeah, the list of ingredients sometimes can sound scary. They can have long names. What I do tell families is that any substance can be toxic at the right dose, so at a high enough dose. So water can be toxic. Sodium, for instance, salt can be toxic, but both of those are things that our bodies also need to survive. There's nothing in a vaccine at a high enough dose to cause any medical problems.
What do you mean at a high enough dose? You mean at the dose that it's
exactly
given?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I would say that, you know, as a practicing physician, every day I'm making medical decisions for my patients. I'm always weighing risk and benefit, and that can change based on the patient. It could change on the pathophysiology of what's happening with the disease process in the patient. It is complex. I would say that with vaccination, it is probably the easiest decision in terms of risk versus benefit, because the risks are very, very, very low. The benefit is very, very high. However, I totally get it when parents say, again, this is my healthy child. You know, I've never seen diphtheria. I've never seen polio. Why do we need to give this vaccine? The safety profile is very, very good, and those diseases can cause really, really serious problems.
We have also seen, however, pharmaceutical companies that, I mean, we're watching this unfold right now with the opioid crisis, pharmaceutical companies that misled doctors who then, whether intentionally or not, misled patients. And so, you know, there are people who say, I don't trust the pharmaceutical company. And as a pediatrician, sure, your job, Dr. Bell, is to know as much as you can, but you do rely on information from other sources to know whether something is safe or not. And you know, there's a lot of, if not vaccine hesitancy, a lot of mistrust of pharmaceutical companies and the information that they may be giving to the medical profession, which then gets, you know, passed on to the patients. And in this case, of course, people are worried about very small children. And so it sort of compounds that emotional concern that you might have. So how and why, I guess, should people who are distrustful trust that you know what's in the vaccine and that you trust the pharmaceutical company that's told you what's in the vaccine and that, you know, down the line it's safe?
Yeah, I did have parents of an unvaccinated child one time tell me that they trusted me, and if I could make the vaccine myself and they could watch me make it, they would allow me to give it to their child, but really were very distrustful of the pharmaceutical companies. And I get that. Vaccines, though, have been around for a long time. They've been studied for a long time, and they're given to all children all across the world. So this isn't a medication that's an experimental medication that we're giving to a handful of people. And we're looking at a few data points and saying, okay, this is what we think is going to happen. These vaccines have been given billions of times. So we have ongoing monitoring that's not done by the pharmaceutical company. That's done by our public health officials. And so I understand that, but this is a commonly used, highly monitored, highly regulated process.
Let's go to Chris, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
My dad was one of the people that worked on the development of the measles vaccine, and the people that were doing that tested it out on their own kids. So I was one of the guinea pigs back in grade school. And then my dad spent his whole career, a lot of it, working on vaccines, polio, AIDS. Well, he worked on AIDS prevention, and he worked on promoting vaccination all over the world. So, and he died in 2003, so he hasn't seen this resurgence of measles. But
how do you think about it, Chris?
I would like to encourage people to take advantage of the preventions that are out there.
Yeah, Chris.
I realize that there's a tiny risk to vaccines, and when the disease is basically gone, you know, that risk seems bigger than the risk of getting the disease. But when the disease is there, then the risk of the disease is greater. So,
yeah, Chris, thank you so much for sharing your personal history with this, and that your father was not only one of the developers of the measles vaccine, but you, in effect, were one of the developers as well, having it tested on you as a child. Another person with personal experience calling in is Brian, who is with us from Montreal. Brian, hi.
Yeah, I want to echo that because I absolutely have no connection to the medical profession or the pharmaceutical industry at all. But as a 70-year-old Montreal man, for the last 24 or so years, I've participated as a volunteer to receive the latest MMR vaccines from the Montreal Children's Hospital Vaccine Study Center. And they call me up every dozen years or so and say, are you still ready to take a dose? And I take it in the report if there's any side effects, if I have any ill effects at all. So I wanted to emphasize people who are suspicious of the medical industrial complex, that there's also just ordinary members of the population like me who have nothing to gain and nothing to lose except a feeling that the community needs this protection. So I offer my body and my time free of charge to make sure the MMR vaccine is still working right, and then if there's any hiccups, I'm not going to get encephalitis. I'm past that point, but a kid isn't.
Brian, thank you very much for sharing your experience with us, too. I didn't realize that there were people who were getting repeatedly injected with the vaccine as sort of testers, as you talk about it. Brian, thanks for calling in. You know, one of the questions here is the conversation, that sort of pinch point of the conversation between a pediatrician and the family, because you have people like Chris Finley with the health department who are trying to do education campaigns, who are saying, you know, this is our state policy, this is why we think you should follow it. But a lot of that decision-making comes down to that moment in the hospital room. And so the question can be, how do physicians better communicate with family members, and how do family members make sure that they're asking the right questions, advocating for their child, that they can feel comfortable knowing, you know, what injections are being given to their kid and what to expect? So I know that, Dr. Bell, you talk a little bit about the case model, corroborate about me, science, and explain and advise. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So one effective way, as pediatricians that we know can work when we talk to families about this, is to, one, really, really let them open up about their concerns and say, yeah, I get it. I get why you're worried about this. I'm glad you're asking.
Do you get why people are worried about it?
I do. If you go on the internet, there is a ton of misinformation out there. And again, anytime you're asking someone to do something preventative, it's tough because you're talking about a healthy kid. They get an injection, right? No child likes an injection, and they cry. And then if it works, which it does, they don't get sick. It's a tough thing, and I totally get that, and we don't see a lot of these diseases, so I understand why it's really hard to explain why it's so important. One thing that we found has been really effective is just to talk about our own personal stories, so things that we've seen, and just say, you know, what I say is, everyone in my life who I love and care about, I recommend that they get vaccinated. That's how important it is to me. And that can be really helpful for a parent to hear. They really like to hear the personal stories, not just from their pediatricians, but from their friends and family. And one thing the general community can do is just to talk about vaccines in a normal way. You know, I brought my kid to the pediatrician the other day and he got vaccinated. I think talking about it, normalizing it, and really trying to erase all hint of judgment and shaming from this conversation is really important. What I see sometimes is that families or individuals get really dug in, and so they may be hesitant about vaccines, and they may tell their friends and family that they're hesitant, and then they might start to change their mind, but they feel really dug in because they have felt shame or pushback from their friends and family. So allowing people permission and space to change their mind, to evolve on this issue, is what we really need to do. And most people vaccinate, most parents vaccinate their children, and we just need to talk about it in a normal, non-shaming way.
Chris Finley, anything to add here on as we wrap up the conversation about measles and about vaccines in Vermont?
I couldn't agree more. I think that sometimes we're seeing sort of this us versus them, and that people do get almost forced to stay within their peace, and that the better that we can address the questions that the individual parent has, the better it is. And one thing I also want to mention is we never talk about that there may be challenges with access to vaccination. And we know that although we do a good job in Vermont, there still are uninsured children and uninsured families. And if you don't have insurance and want to get your child vaccinated or want to check on yours, if you're under 65, our district offices do provide vaccination for those that are uninsured.
We can provide a link to the Vermont Department of Health on our website. Go to vpr.org and click on today's Vermont edition about vaccination. Christine Finley is Immunization Program Manager with the Vermont Department of Health. Health, and Dr. Rebecca Bell is a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.